Well, hello there. Welcome to this week's edition of the Free Press Radio Show. My name is Brian Hanks. I am the co-host for this little joy run that we call the Free Press Radio Show. I'm the editor of the Free Press in beautiful, lovely Kinston, North Carolina. His name is John the Firefighter Dawson. He's a producer. He's a co-host. He's the guy that is, if you see Dawson over the next few days and his shoulders look a little weighed down, they should be because he's carrying this podcast today. How are you doing today, John Dawson?
After that filthy story that went on before we hit the record button. Actually, we were recording. I'm just going to save it for when I need that raise.
Do me a favor then. Tell everybody why they call you the firefighter.
Can't do that. Can't do that.
Anywho, we've got a very special guest for you here. We're going to be talking to here in a few minutes. Ian Anderson, one of the founders of Jethro Tull. One of the great rock bands out there. And yeah, listen, I like Jethro Tull. I like their music. But one of the things, if you ever want to get under John Dawson's skin, and God knows I love to poke the bear with John Dawson on a variety of subjects, insist to him that there was actually a man named Jethro Tull.
There was. He was the inventor of the seed drill. And the band is named, they for some reason, their manager or somebody pulled that name from that guy.
But tell people how I pick on you, and you know when I ask you, you know, is Jethro Tull the lead singer of Jethro Tull?
And oh yeah, Ian Anderson in the interview talks about how people will still walk up to him and say, "Mr. Tull, will you autograph this for me?"
That's fantastic.
For people that don't know, he's basically the mainstay of Jethro Tull. The guitar player Martin Barr has been on every Jethro Tull album other than the first one, but other than that, Ian Anderson is the thread that goes from the beginning to whatever state they're in now, and he's written pretty much every song, so he kind of is Jethro Tull, except for, you know, Martin Barr would have to be in there. Well, when I was in high school, kind of an older hippie guy over in LaGrange gave me a copy of Living in the Past with Jethro Tull, and it's like a compilation of their early, before Aqualung stuff. And of course, Aqualung is a great album, but it's plagued to death on the radio. But the stuff that came before it is what kind of hooked me into them. And they never kind of sat back and just go out and work every 4 or 5 years. They kept putting out new stuff. And Ian Anderson's still putting out albums right now at a clip as fast as, or maybe even faster than, supposedly current artists.
Well, I tell you what, let's talk about Ian Anderson a little bit, who you're going to be chatting with here in a moment. He's known throughout the world of rock music as the flute and voice behind the legendary Jethro Tull. He's celebrating his 46th year as a recording and performing musician this year in 2014. He was born in 1947 in Scotland. Following a traditional grammar school education, he moved on to art college to study fine art before deciding on an attempt at a musical career. Jethro Tull formed in 1968 out of the amalgamation of the John Evan Band and McGregor's Engine, two blues-based local UK groups. Still enjoying a lengthy, if intermittent, ongoing career, Jethro Tull has released 30 studio and live albums, selling more than 60 million copies since the band first performed at London's famous Marquee Club. After undertaking more than 3,000 concerts in 40-something countries, throughout 4 decades, Jethro Tull has played typically 100 concerts each year to long-standing as well as new fans worldwide. Widely recognized as a man who introduced the flute to rock music, Ian Anderson remains the crowned exponent of the popular and rock genres of flute playing. So far, no pretender to the throne has stepped forward. Ian also plays ethnic flutes and whistles together with acoustic guitar and the mandolin family of instruments, providing the acoustic textures which are an integral part of most of the Jethro Tull repertoire. Anderson has so far recorded 6 diverse albums under his own name during a long career. 1983's Walk Into Light, the flute instrumental Divinity's album for EMI's Classical Music Division in 1995, which reached number 1 in the relevant Billboard chart. And the more acoustic collection of songs, The Secret Language of Birds, Ruby's Dance, plus rock albums Thick as a Brick 2, and now 2014's Homo Erraticus, which I know you've had a chance to listen to that. Dawson, what do you think about that? Well, give us a little quickie review on Homo Erraticus.
The quickie review is that it seems to be like a theme of man's desire to move and be mobile. I think there's a thin, I don't know if it's thin, but it's not an overt reference to migration and immigration. And it sounds like a Jethro Tull album. If it's aside from Martin Barr not playing guitar, it sounds just like Jethro Tull.
Well, one of the neat things is he's toured more and more recently as simply Ian Anderson, often with orchestras, string quartets, and featured soloists. Most of the concerts scheduled for 2014 is going to feature Homo Erraticus together with an hour of favorites from the Jethro Tull catalog. I bet you didn't know this, Dawson. He lives on a farm in the southwest of England where he has a recording studio and office. He's been married for 37 years to Shauna, who is also an active director of their music and other companies. They have two children, James and Gail, who work in the music and TV film industries, respectively. Now, here's an interesting fact that another fact I bet you didn't know, John Dawson. Gail is married to Andrew Lincoln. Does that name ring a bell?
No.
Well, it should, because he's the star of the TV series The Walking Dead. You know, that's on AMC. They're a very popular series about the zombies on AMC.
People love some zombies right now.
I can't get into zombies.
I knew the bit about the farm and all that. I did not know he had a kid married to somebody who was a zombie.
A couple more fun facts here. Gail and Andrew have two children, Matilda and Arthur. They live in the rural splendor of England.
Rural?
Reminds me of 30 Rock. Remember?
Rural Juror.
The Rural Juror. But they live in the rural splendor of England's West Country. They keep ducks, chickens, a cat named Buna, and a fruit orchard. Man. Andrew has a new tractor and expensive wellies. And do you know what wellies are?
Boots.
How did you know that?
I think you told me when you were practicing that before we hit the record button.
You're painfully honest.
Yeah.
They're Wellington boots, the iconic waterproof footwear of the British countryside. I tell you what, man, without further ado, let's get Ian Anderson on the phone.
Your new album, Homo Erraticus, continues a story that began with Thick as a Brick and continued into Thick as a Brick 2, your previous solo work. The way I understand it, the first Thick as a Brick was a bit of a spoof of prog rock concept albums, but it seems like Thick as a Brick 2 and Homo Erraticus take the plot fairly seriously compared to the original. So the question is, has the original brief changed, or is it still a bit of a spoof of those types of albums?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a spoof, but it is typical, I suppose, of most of my work over the years, to try and embrace elements of humor in the lyrics and try and keep even sometimes heavy, dark subjects a little more light and approachable through the use of humor and whimsy. You probably haven't written the word whimsy yet today, so it's a good first time. In fact, you may never have written it in your entire journalistic career, so I don't know. Anyway, I'm throwing in the word whimsy because it is that sort of thoughtful, musing kind of humor that comes from a kind of little flight of fancy. And that's part of the way I write. So I think that was there on Thick as a Brick 1, certainly there on Thick as a Brick 2, is probably there on albums like Aqualung or... pick anyone really along the way. You're going to find that whimsical humor evident. But I should remove the notion really that we're talking about a trilogy here, because it's only the writer's device of a nom de plume or an alter ego, Gerald Bostock, which links anything here and is not really a continuity in subject matter in any way between Thick as a Brick 1, 2, and Homo Erraticus. It's Homo Erraticus as a spoof species of Homo sapiens is his own man.
In a recent interview I saw with you, you said that the theme of migration and mobility, hunting and gathering, was a strong theme that ran through Homo Erraticus. Could you briefly expound on the sort of the inspiration for the lyrics for these new songs?
Well, I think in many countries of the world, politicians and resident populations are concerned about the inevitable increase in demands for immigration into our respective countries, as you know, hundreds of thousands of Syrians are being forced to flee their homes, and many of us have played host to an increase in populations of Iraqis in the last years, as well as, of course, many from nations in Africa, or in Eastern Europe, in our case. So, you know, we are facing up to the reality that we're not a stable population any more than we have been any time in the last 10,000 years. We have others knocking on our doorsteps wanting to come in, just as we, you and I, have ancestors who did exactly that some indefinable period ago. We are all on the move looking for a better life, and of course rules and regulations in regard to national boundaries and the level of the quiet level of xenophobia that exists in any country to some extent. We have to recognize that, understand it, and make some very painful and difficult decisions regarding who we choose to allow to come and live in our midst, to be part of our future society, to be part of the fabric of our countries. And it's an increasingly difficult reality that we have to face. We have to be mindful of the needs of others, to be welcoming, to be hospitable wherever we can. But our children, our grandchildren, are going to be faced with some very tough decisions in voting for those politicians that have policies that reflect the desires of the people. You know, in not too long from now, we face a new general election in the United Kingdom, happily still united, although it was a close call last week. And immigration is going to be one of the really hot topics on which, indeed, an election may be won or lost. At the moment, most of our population have kind of had enough of the relatively free immigration policies of the last governments and want to see much tighter restrictions put on people coming in. And unfortunately, that does reflect on a level of xenophobia, which is sometimes quite unpleasant among certain people in the country. But I rather think, since it is a discussion that is now out of the home, out of the public bar, and into the streets, into the office, into the schools, you know, we can have a grown-up discussion and debate about such issues and try to find the best way forward. So immigration, or looking at it in the broader sense of migration, the movement of people, it's a hot political potato, therefore topical that I should write about that. But I'm trying to write about it in a way that will maybe help people understand that we're all from somewhere else. If we go back far enough in history, if we go back some 60,000 years or a little more, then we probably find we're all out of Africa. Somewhere in Northeast Africa, maybe even a single tribe of people were responsible for what we call Homo sapiens, and it's spread around the planet today. So, you know, let's all remember that we were all from somewhere else. And just because we gave the North American Indians casino rights doesn't wipe the guilt from our conscience or our faces, because we all stamped on somebody's head to get what we want.
Do you set aside time daily or weekly to write, or do you just put pen to paper when an idea bubbles up? What's your process?
Well, in years gone by, when I was on tour in a hotel room, I'd also have a guitar with me, and I would just write whenever the moment presented itself, or whenever there was, you know, an hour in hand or whatever. Then it would be a question of squeezing it in where I could. But when I'm at home, as I do tend to have a more organized work and leisure pattern these days, then I can say, right, 9 a.m., January the 1st, every 2 years, I will sit down and go into my writing space with an empty head and no preconceived thoughts or ideas about what I'm going to make the next project. And that's quite exciting. It's also quite a challenge, because if by midday on the 1st of January things aren't going too well, then I could become a desperate man and possibly want to shoot myself, but so far the muse comes to visit, usually around 10 a.m. It's her normal appointment for entering into my consciousness.
What was the first song you got a sketch together for Homo Erraticus, and that did that inform the rest of the songs, or was each song kind of its own individual person and it just seemed to coalesce when you were finished?
Well, it's a very organic process, writing music anyway, because you have in your mind what you just did yesterday, and so there is a natural following on, a kind of a sequential build of ideas and thoughts and constant back referencing to previous bits and trying to keep yourself from repetition, but at the same time make some of those deliberate references to pieces that you've perhaps written 2 or 3 or 4 days before. But I think, you know, in terms of working on that album, Homo Erraticus began with an opening flute line, a piece of music that was instrumental, which just led itself into the first notion of a vocal verse, and for no particularly good reason, the Doggerland suddenly came into my mind, being a low-lying piece of rather boggy, marshy land that linked northwestern Europe to what became the British Isles after the last ice age and the sea levels rose, flooding the Doggerland and putting it a couple of hundred feet below the North Sea. So the Doggerland is the means by which our earliest ancestors crossed over from Europe into the British Isles. It in itself just gave me that notion of the movement of people, the settling of new lands, and so that by the end of day one or day two of writing, you know, I started to piece together the whole theme of the album with a number of little kind of bullet point paragraphs, which in fact appear on the album cover artwork, the loose descriptions of the various sections of music.
I saw Jethro Tull in concert maybe 8-9 years ago, and the Chieftains were the opening act, and it was a great show. And the highlight of the Jethro Tull set to me was when you played songs from Secret Language of Birds. Did you not think that material was proper for a Jethro Tull album because it was mainly acoustic, or was that kind of the first step towards establishing a solid solo career after Tull shut down?
Well, I think the songs on that and many other songs, some of which weren't even recorded, have always featured as little extras, as it were, in the Jethro Tull set, going back years and years and years. I can remember even shortly after Martin Barr joined the band in 1969 that we featured one of his instrumental pieces, which was never recorded and never developed beyond a little snippet of live performance on stage. So that sort of thing has always been a part of the show, to put in unlikely songs, sometimes trying things out before they were recorded, and sometimes songs that may have appeared for instance, one of Martin Barr's solo albums. He's often played one of those pieces on stage as a guitar instrumental. So it's a common practice to do that, but I don't think you want to put in too many of those, since they're not technically part of the Jethro Tull repertoire. And the situation today is that I, after some 46, 47 years of touring as Jethro Tull, then I'd like to think of it more as being a summation of that body of work, that huge repertoire of some 350 songs that I've written over the years, and which are the catalogue. That's what Jethro Tull means to me today, in the musical sense anyway, that it's a vast body of work written by me almost always and performed by some 28 different musicians who make up the different lineups of Jethro Tull over the years. But it doesn't mean that Jethro Tull is no more. It's just that as things stand at the moment, then I tend to tour using my own name in the forefront, because a lot of people still don't know who I am. In fact, just the other day, somebody came up and asked for my autograph and said, "Thanks very much, Mr. Tull."
Even this far into it, you still get that?
Well, you do, particularly from the guys who are actually just trying to get your signature on a
for eBay, yeah.
Final albums to sell on eBay, because they're not exactly really fans. They're just people trying to make a buck out of selling your likeness. So yes, but it does happen. I mean, that is the reality. Lots of people think of me as being the central character, the logo figure, standing on one leg playing the flute, and I just would like, maybe it's just vanity from a senile old fool, but I would rather like people to know my name before I die.
Homo Erraticus is available in several formats, including CD, DVD packages, and vinyl. Do you prefer one format over another, or does it just depend on the situation and where you happen to be when you want to listen?
Well, for the last 15 years, I've been someone who, having embraced digital recording from its earliest origins back in the 80s, long before it was a commercial retail item, but a form of recording and mastering in the studio. I've been familiar with digital audio files, and I guess from the point of view of ease of storage, access, and audio fidelity, I'm much more comfortable listening to high-quality digital files than I am listening to CDs and certainly to vinyl. I mean, vinyl obviously has, for many people, a sentimental value. They like the size of it, the shape of it, the tactile nature of a big package on which they can, for once, actually make out the liner notes, because, of course, when those things were reduced to cassette size or even CDs, you really had to wear some pretty powerful reading glasses to be able to see what was actually on the album cover. So I can understand the sentimental attachment people have to vinyl, but from an audio point of view, it's not really likely to be in the same category as a high quality digital file, or even arguably a CD. And the sentimentality that people have is the same as they have for certain models of motorcycles or wristwatches or things that have, for them, a certain romantic and emotional attachment, but aren't necessarily going to be the best way of either telling the time or getting to work in the morning, depending on whether you go to work on a wristwatch or you tell the time by reading your Harley Davidson.
You're one of the few, and I know you despise the term classic rock artist. You're a musician who's been around, stood the test of time, I guess is the way to say it. But how much, it had to take a lot of guts to go out and do a new project without the Jethro Tull name, because it's, even bands that go out under the name, it's classic rock fans are very lazy when it comes to new material. And it seems like you're being pretty successful getting your new music to Jethro Tull fans. Is that how you're perceiving it so far?
Well, I think it's, commercially speaking, fairly suicidal for any old established band to release a new album, because, people don't want a new Rolling Stones album or a new Who album. They want to hear a new old Rolling Stones album. In other words, they fondly imagine that somehow, if it could be recreated, that the Rolling Stones would go into the studio and come out with songs like that sounded in the same vein as Jumping Jack Flash or Brown Sugar, then of course they might learn to like it if they heard it enough on radio. But it's the reality is that that's not going to happen. The Stones are noticeably absent from the studio, and their last studio album, didn't sell particularly well. It was great as a tool to sell their back catalogue, which is why their record company paid a lot of money for a new Rolling Stones album. But in itself, I saw the SoundScan figures. I know what it sold. It was obviously, in its own right, a huge disappointment to the record company and to the band. But I don't really go into it with thoughts of commercially trying to satisfy me, my bank manager, or indeed anyone. So as long as I can cover my costs of making a new album, I'm doing it because I want true that generally people are out of their comfort zone when they have to listen to new material by old bands. And the reality is, in most cases, it's probably not going to be that great. It's probably not going to stack up very well against their best earlier work. That's what people imagine, and in most cases, that's what it turns out to be. So I make no claims for what I do now, but it's for me to be a little more adventurous, not necessarily brave, but adventurous in doing new work and hoping that it will impact on at least some people. And for me, kind of important not just to go out and make every tour a best-of tour just like the last one. So I'm able to draw upon not only a lot of old material from 1968 onwards, but also to throw some new material into the mix too, which keeps me engaged with the challenge of performing live. It just doesn't become repetitious. It doesn't become a chore. And I don't feel like a jukebox on legs or with wings, since I have to fly to many places where I travel.
Well, Tull, it seems like fans of Jethro Tull, and I would even say The Who more than The Stones, they would have the largest segment of fans that did want new material. I mean, I wouldn't... I would much rather go see an Ian Anderson show where I knew half of the show was going to be something new than to go to a Stone show and hear Satisfaction for the 9 millionth time.
Yeah, well, it's understandable. If I went to see the Rolling Stones, I would want to hear Satisfaction. I have no problem with the idea that for certain bands, they go out and they just relive their glory years from, you know, 5 decades ago, whatever it might be. However, if Pete Townsend put pen to paper or digit to QWERTY, then he would possibly, we would hope, come up with another great concept album like Tommy, and stage it and put it on the tour with lots of, and put it on the road with lots of guests, and we'd all be very excited about it. But I guess in our hearts, we probably wouldn't expect it to succeed, either artistically or commercially, and it would be a brave Pete Townsend who entered into such a project at his age, and with only one surviving member of the Who apart from him, it would always seem perhaps a bit of an apology to go out and do that. But we live in hope that some longer established artists will come out with a masterpiece late in life, not beyond credibility, but just in the realms of the highly unlikely. And on that sad but yet uplifting kind of a note, we'll have to say goodbye.
Outstanding interview there with Ian Anderson, Dawson. But you didn't have to bogart the whole interview. You could have, let me ask a question or two.
Yeah, you were still. I know what you were going to ask him. You were going to refer to him as Mr. Tull, and I was having none of it.
Well, and I was also sitting over here Googling wellies, too. You know, I think, dude, Wellington boots, man, those things are cool. I think I'm going to have to get me a pair of those.
Yeah, well, it's
why didn't you ask him about the wellies?
There's a lot of bogs. I only had him for so much time.
Yeah.
But as far, if I remember correctly, I think the first Jethro Tull album came out in 68.
Mm-hmm.
And his flute playing is on it. And the first Moody Blues album came out, well, with Ray Thomas, the flute player. That album came out in 67. So I think it's down to him and Ray Thomas as to who introduced flute into the world of rock music.
Well, tell you what, other than Ron Burgundy, nobody does it better than Ian Anderson.
Well, he even says Aqualung when he's doing his little flute thing, I believe.
Yeah, he does, yes.
I kept hoping to see Ian Anderson in the sequel.
Would that not have been awesome? That's what should have happened. I wonder if they contacted him.
I've heard him reference it. I know he's seen it, but...
Well, fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to put a bow on this week's edition of the Free Press Radio Show. If we're doing a music edition, we might as well... I've got to ask you, I think we talked about this on the Free Press Football Show last week, but a lot of people probably, that would listen to this would not listen to that. But I asked you about the U2 release. You know, I'm a huge mm-hmm. U2 fan, and... it's just been a public relations disaster.
Well, here's my unsolicited opinion.
That's what I was getting. I was getting ready to solicit it, so it is a solicited opinion.
Every great band that's hung around for more than 10 minutes is going to have one album in their canon that's not up to scratch. The Beatles, the Stones, the Who, Floyd, they've all had at least one album that was kind of...
Jethro Tull?
Yeah, they've all had...
I'm just trying to make it relevant to this, too.
Yeah, okay. I mean, they had put an album out in 84, I think, called Under Wraps. I think the songs were good, but it was kind of steeped in that 80s production that I think they... When you hear them play the songs live, they're fantastic. But, you know, if you stack up what all of these bands have done and they've got, like, you know, 10, 20 great albums and one dud, you can't expect people to be geniuses all the time. But that being said, I mean, like R.E.M., put out an album called Around the Sun. It was their third, and it wasn't like, God, this is crap. It was just like... I can't believe they put it out. It was just kind of lifeless, sounded like they were tired, something. And that's my thing with this U2 album. It's not a good album, but that doesn't mean their next one won't be great. Neil Young has put out maybe 30 albums in his career, and 10 of them are awful. 20 of them are great.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people that are trying to write them off are just a little premature. And the thing with the internet is every jackass who can type thinks they're Lester Bangs.
I know who Lester Bangs is.
He thinks they're Lester Bangs. And they don't know how hard it is. Those guys make a lot of money, but it's hard to come up with songs that haven't been done and recorded and all that stuff. So they just need to, if you don't like it, just...
Oh, I agree.
Take it
easy.
Well,
but there are a reason people are called critics. I mean, they have them to...
Well, I got no problem with somebody
who's... Because you're an award-winning critic.
I got no problem with somebody who sort of knows what they're talking about and it's kind of their job to critique it and have discussions. But, you know, these people that... I don't understand why people went crazy. Oh, my God, they put a free album in my iTunes.
There's a portion of it. Let me ask you this. I'm going to make it applicable to you. No, I'm sorry that I'm interrupting you, but I can make this applicable to you. What if in your iTunes account, you know, you pay for your iCloud every year and blah, blah, blah. Woke up tomorrow, there's a free portion, but I mean, if you want more in it, like I pay $100 a year to get 200 megs or 200 gigs so I can store all my pictures on the iCloud.
Mm-hmm.
What if you woke up tomorrow morning and there was a Wiz Khalifa album downloaded into your iTunes account?
I would delete it immediately.
It wouldn't upset you even in the least. If you were you are traveling with tax deduction number one and tax deduction number two, and you've got your thing on shuffle, you've got your iTunes account on shuffle, and a Wiz Khalifa song just pops up on your stereo with the kids in the car, that wouldn't upset you?
That would tick me off. Yeah. But I figured you would see the album before you hit shuffle.
That's what happened to a lot of people. That's the number one complaint that I've seen. And who are you talking to? I'm the biggest U2 fan in the world.
Yeah.
I really am. But there are people that are just, it's almost, they considered it an invasion of privacy or an invasion of whatever, that, hey, this is my iTunes account, and this album was forced into my thing. Yes, I can delete it, but it wasn't even that you could easily delete it. Apple had released a whole update of how to delete it. You couldn't just go in and... Mm-hmm. You know, swipe it, delete, because it was permanently put into your iTunes account.
Well, I have two responses to that.
Okay.
To me, that's basically like people get spam in their email. Nobody lights a torch and tries to storm Yahoo or Google's offices. storm because I got a coupon for sneakers in my email that I didn't want. I mean, it's not like people dumped a couch on their lawn. And as far as... From somebody who's gone through heaven and hell to make albums and studios and get them on iTunes and stuff, everything you said there is right, but music consumers have become so lazy, and the radio stations have become so monopolized, and the record labels have ruined music so much, you have to come up with a way to get people to hear what you're doing. If somebody came to me and said, we're going to take the next Third of Never album and put it in everybody's iTunes account for free, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
Well, don't get it twisted. Apple paid U2 $100 million to do that. So it's not like...
And U2 scammed them because it ain't worth $100 million. I know how much it costs to record albums. Yeah. That album might mixing, master, it might have cost, it might have cost 150 grand, 200 grand.
Wow.
Maybe.
Wow. It just, as, again, you tell everybody, who's the biggest U2 apologist that you know?
You are, but I think I was fair in my review.
I think you were, too. I mean, I think you were, too. And listen, I have looped that album a dozen times.
Nothing sticks in your head.
The first song. That's the only part I'll disagree with you. The first song, it does. It's banging, and it comes out strong. And then it goes to Pablo.
It's there. It's there around the sun. It just kind of sits there, nothing.
Well, you know, there's, I don't know. I mean, in the last several albums, there, somebody, I can't even take credit for this. I wish I could because it was genius. Maybe it was you or somebody said, wrote or something, that it seems like this is a Bono album. It seems like it's like Bono went out on his own and did an independent project.
It's very focused on lyrics, but the Edge's guitar, which is what pulled me in, it isn't there.
It's not there.
It's like six or seven songs in before you hear some, oh, that's the Edge.
There you go. Well, except for the first song. I'm going to disagree with you again. I think the first song, to me, on a using your scale that you do every week in the Free Press, your five-star thing, it's a four-star song. I like the first song, the Joey Ramone song. Mm-hmm. I think it's powerful. I think it's got a good beat. I think it draws you in, and then it just drops you off. Well, it doesn't even really drop you off a cliff because the rest of it's not.
It's just like the cars. It's like the cars idling, but it just doesn't start moving.
Outstanding. That's a great analysis. Seriously, it's not terrible. I mean, it's not like some of the experimental stuff they've done, like they did with Pop and even with Zooropa right after the Octane
Baby. At least Pop had something going on.
It did. This, it sounds like commercial stuff. It sounds like...
Well, see, Coldplay has adopted the U2s. Maybe they're trying to not sound like themselves because people will say they'll sound like Coldplay.
trying to sound like U2.
Who are basically ripping off U2. I mean, that's why the Police had to keep changing their sound.
Yeah.
Because there were like 900 bands. By the time they got to Synchronicity, they had sounded nothing like they did when they started.
Where does Synchronicity rank in the all-time... I mean, all-time... I mean, do percentages. I'm not saying the top 10 albums all-time, but is it in the top 1% of all albums, top 2% of all albums released?
If it didn't have those songs, Mother and Miss Gradenko on it, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that side, too... it's hard to beat that second side.
Yeah, Synchronicity, man. That's in young Brian Hanks's.
That was the first album I owned.
Was it really?
Yeah.
It was one of the first I owned. It was probably up there. I think the I can't even believe it.
Well, I was 10, so you should have gotten something.
I had a Fleetwood Mac album. I guess Rumors was the first album that I had, and. Play, I mean, literally, album. I mean, people, you know, will think tapes or 8-tracks. No, I had the album of Rumors. Good God. Played that thing to death. I don't even know where it is. I wish I knew where it was. But it was up there. Synchronicity was up there. I mean, that's when I really discovered music. I was really not that much of a person into music until I was 14 or 15 anyway. And that's when, you know, Purple Rain... For me, Purple Rain was a life changer for me. Thriller, go ahead and laugh at me, but Thriller.
I had Thriller.
Awesome.
Somebody gave it to me for my birthday.
Yeah, Thriller was awesome. Yeah. Synchronicity was awesome. Mm-hmm. Just all in that time frame, there were three or four albums that just seriously just kind of changed my life, as it were. I had a friend named Brian Lowe, who I'm Facebook friends now. He's a guitarist now up in. He's returned home. He's up in Wilkes County, but he was the biggest Who. I'd never even really heard. I guess I'd heard of the Who, but I wasn't that big of a fan. But he turned me on to a little bit of the Who my freshman and sophomore year. And until I met you, he was the biggest Who fan that I had ever known.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have eclipsed him definitely in that department.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. You know, and I'm defending you too.
Yeah.
It's not over. It's just there's bumps in the road. But the new Who single has got more life in it than anything on the U2 album. Those guys are 70.
Well.
So I think it was they purposely made the songs that way. I don't think they're physically unable. They just decided we're going to do this time.
Well, it just disappoints me because, you know, there's going to be another tour. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be kind of, the dates have not been announced yet, but I'm telling you this. You and I have now seen the Who together. We've seen Yes together.
Procol Harum. Procol Harum opened for Yes.
Yeah.
Don't you do it. I'm going to come across this desk.
Out of respect to Purple Harum, I won't. No, Procol Harum, I won't do it.
They're not going to say Procol Karen or anything like that.
Yeah, so Purple Karen. Yeah, yeah, there you go. What else? I thought we had seen... Oh, we saw Molly Ringwald a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Is that all we've seen together? I thought we had seen more acts together. I know we're both searching our memory banks right now. But
you
anyway.
Tried to get me to go to that thing in Tijuana, but I didn't want anything to do with that.
Oh, that donkey
the
show?
The SPCA. Now, see...
What? They were dancing donkeys.
I was
going
to say...
Where are you going with that?
See, I was
going
to say with the SPCA... had a warning up, so I didn't go.
Yeah.
I was going to let that sit there, but now you've...
Yeah, I always cross that line, don't I?
On the nose, on the nose.
Well, I'm going to say this, and I'll leave it at that. Well, is Ian Anderson coming anywhere around here? I mean, I know you said that in your show, or in your interview with him, as I was sitting here Googling stuff, listening to you conduct the interview.
Durham, on
Durham.
The 4th in 3 days.
On October the 4th, so be sure to get up to Durham and check out Ian. Are you going up there for that, or...
Are you kidding me?
I don't know.
Can't even afford the gas.
Anyway. Be sure to go check out Ian Anderson on October the 4th up in Durham.
I saw Jethro Tull and the Chieftains back in 2001. It was a great show. The Chieftains were great, too.
Okay. Well, very good. Very good. Well, I'll just say this. Whenever U2 announces... You know, I want to take my wife. I want to, you know, go hang out with my brother again because, you know, he enjoyed the show last time. Our good mutual friend, Jonathan Massey, he's fun to go to concerts with. I love all them, whatever. You and I are going to a U2 show on my dime. Mm. We are going to a U2 show. And I cannot believe the hundreds of concerts you've been to in your life and shows and everything. You've never seen U2. I am going to be there. For your first experience, I am going. Like I said, you know what? We didn't pay you for being our officiant. Consider this your payment for being our officiant at our wedding. Okay?
Can you get him to play all of Octung Baby, and I'll go?
No, you're going. You're going. You go ahead and whenever they announce it, I'm hoping they're going to play Raleigh, but they try not to do the same venues and back-to-back tours. And they played Raleigh on the last time through, so I'm a little worried that they're not going to do Raleigh, which probably means. I've seen them 26 times. I mean, I know how they do their, you know, when they do the East Coast swing. It's probably going to be Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Very likely it'll be Charlotte. But here's what I would love to see. They won't do it, but I'd love to see them play Greenville. Greenville, if they played the football stadium at Greenville. Yeah, well, they played stadiums. I mean, when they played Raleigh, they played Carter-Finley. Why couldn't they play Dowdy-Ficklin over in Greenville? You can get 50,000 people in there. Seriously.
I think for them, they would need to play close to a big metropolitan area because I think Greenville...
You don't think U2 could get 50,000 people to Greenville?
I think it would be easier for them to sell the tickets in a bigger city.
We should start the
surrounding
movement.
Greenville is like a lot of rural places. And
we should start a hashtag, bring U2 to Greenville. What do you think? They're planning their tour right now. This is organic. We just came up with this. Do you notice how I'm making you part of the...
No, you came up with that one.
Bring U2 to Greenville. Would that not be awesome for U2 to come to Greenville, North Carolina?
I know a guy that saw Jethro Tull at ECU in 1970.
Really?
He said
where did he play?
They used to
like
have
a club or a venue?
It was some auditorium over there. He said they used to have a lot of big bands come through. The Allman Brothers played there in 95 maybe, mm-hmm. Something like that.
What?
98, somewhere along in there.
We need to start the hashtag, bring U2 to Greenville. What do you think?
Will never happen. Won't ever happen.
We can try. Because that would be an easy trip, man. Because, I mean, like I said, it's either going to be Charlotte. I doubt it's Raleigh. It's going to be Charlotte or Charlottesville. And then probably Clemson. They hadn't played Clemson in a couple of tours.
It's going to be interesting to see how the backlash is going to affect...
Ticket sales. But I don't think it's going to be that bad. I mean, the last couple of albums haven't been... I mean, they've gone to number one, but like this album, for instance, it can't even be registered because they didn't sell any albums.
But they've started sending out vinyl copies to stores, which I think means it so they can get in on the Grammys. They've started sending out vinyl records to some record stores.
I did not know that.
And... That's the bad thing about the internet, man. You know, they did this. There's too many people with opinions with access to computers. That's what I'm going to say.
Well, and I agree with that. I totally agree with that. Well, listen, We're going to go ahead and wrap up this edition of the Free Press Music Show. If you like that.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I think that's all we've talked about. And let's just leave it at that. I love it. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone, that's the beauty of this. Some weeks we talk politics. Some weeks we talk sports. Some weeks we talk music. So
I do my best to stay out of politics. I let you and the grown-ups talk about politics.
Well, speaking of which, good Lord, we've got to start getting those scheduled. Those will be coming around in the next couple of weeks. We'll be bringing those to you, all the candidates in Lenora County. Will hopefully be joining us here on the Free Press Radio Show. We'll also, we got some other surprises coming to you down the pipe. But listen, thank you so much for joining us this week on the Free Press Radio Show. Want to thank Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull for being a part of the show this week. That music you heard, the music you heard there at the beginning of the show and right here at the end, from the mind and the fingers of the founder of Third of Never. Have you ever heard of that band there, John Dawson?
I hear they're pretty good.
They're pretty damn good. Green Roses is elevated and probably into my top 50 songs of all time.
You're the one.
Whatever, dude. Green Roses is awesome, man. We need to have a conversation about that one. I can break that song down. I looped that song the other day doing lookbacks back in the morgue. Mm-hmm. I bet I looped that, I don't know, couldn't even tell you, 12, 13, 14 times. I can sing it now. So whenever you need like a guest singer at your next appearance,
yeah,
or I'll do. I'll help with harmony. I couldn't be the lead singer of it.
Well, you know, we don't play that. We played it live once. It's very tedious to play that live.
God, in all sincerity, you think I'm busting your balls, but I'm saying this sincerely. That's a beautiful song, and I love how it ends. It doesn't just end. It's almost like it just kind of fades off.
Mm-hmm.
You can almost anticipate it coming right, being lift. You know what I'm saying? Coming right back up. It's that kind of song. And
as much pain in the ass as we went through to get that song written and recorded, I'm glad one person liked it.
Well, guess what? You're sitting across from him. Anyway, the music you heard at the beginning and right here at the end of the show from you, John Dawson. If people want to find out more about that, about your music, about the books you've written, anything else, how do they do that?
JohnDawson.com, JohnDawson.com.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Free Press Radio Show. We'll see you next week on your iPod.